Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Our guest today is Len Testa. He is co-author of the unofficial guides to Walt Disney World, Disneyland, Disney Cruises, and more. He is the guy who runs touringplans.com. We're going to talk a lot about what that website does today, what their mission is. They are sort of a research arm of the unofficial guides. He's the co-host of the Disney Dish podcast, which I have listened to hundreds of episodes along with Jim Hill, and they talk about all sorts of things Disney, past, present, future, and very timely. It's weekly. If you're at all interested in the history or future of Disney, it's a great place to just dive in. He's also one of the co-hosts of Disney Unpacked, a YouTube series all about Disney, and each episode has its own theme. So he's also just a renowned computer scientist and data collector. So he's put all that together, and that's sort of his life work, is this whole touring plans concept. I really have tried to make this, because usually our guests, as you know, are music related. So we do talk a little bit about music in this episode, and that's the part that we aired on the radio show. But today's interview is a 90-minute conversation. We're going to talk about a little bit about Disney's, well, at least the perceived greediness of the management, whether or not that's true or not. We're going to talk about why people are so devoted to the Disney brand and to the Disney theme parks. We're going to talk about the history and the future of the parks. We're going to talk about tips to save time if you are headed to Disney World. So, and lots more. So I have designed this conversation, hopefully, to be of interest to people who know way more than me about Disney, to people who don't know anything about Disney but are a little bit curious, and also to people who are just interested in interesting people, because I believe Len Testa is a super interesting person. So hopefully you fit into one of those groups. I hope so. And you will enjoy this. I'm at michaels@wfmu.org. If you enjoy it, I guess I'm also at that same address if you don't like it. But I have a feeling you're going to like this one, because he's, like I said, super interesting guy. So check all those websites, and I hope you find this interesting as I do. Me and Len Testa. Len Testa, welcome to the podcast. Good morning. I'm so thrilled to talk to you. I'm super excited. I'm kind of a Disney nerd. How you doing?
I'm well. Thanks for having me on, Michael. I appreciate it.
All right. We're going to start off with a question, and we'll see if you and me are on the same page.
Sure.
What are the two things, the two biggest reasons people you run into on the street say they don't like going to Disney World?
It's expensive, and they wait in long lines.
Bing! That is exactly correct. You get a canned ham.
If there was a third, it'd be the hassle of...
Yeah.
Thank you. Is it steamed?
What's the third?
It's complicated.
Yeah, and it's getting more complicated. So let me give you some background, right? My dad was an actor. He moved to Los Angeles, and I would go visit him, and we would go to Disneyland, and this is in the 1970s. And my experience was, you know, you get there at 11 o'clock, you wait 70 to 90 minutes for every single ride in the hot sun, and then somebody start, you know, and then you go home. And I went a couple times in my 20s and 30s, and then when I had a kid, things... You know, then I really started to go just about once a year, and Disney had changed so much, and it really blew my mind. So the long lines that I experienced as a kid, I just thought that's how it was. I just thought that's what you had to do. Then I bought your book when I became a dad, and I really became an evangelist for the unofficial guide, because it approached going to the parks in a completely different way, and it gave this, what you call a touring plan, of how to go and not wait online so much. So how much time will folks save if they use the advice on touringplans.com and in the unofficial guide?
So we've actually done head-to-head tests with families in the parks, and we think that if you're following one of the touring plans from either the book or the website on a busy day in the Magic Kingdom, you could save 4 hours in line.
So when you say head-to-head tests, you sent two groups of people, one to randomly do rides and attractions and shows, and one to follow a very specific guide, and that's how you come up with that number?
Yeah, so we're scientists at heart. Like, everyone who works on the unofficial guide and most of the people who work for touring plans are scientists or operations research people. So we're comfortable doing A-B tests. And the way that we do it in the parks is we'll get groups of families, and one group will say, you know, we'll tell them, here's a list of like, you know, 15 or 20 attractions. See them in whatever order you want and tell us how long it takes you to see it all. And, you know, write down how long you wait in line for each one of them. And then the other group will give the exact same list of attractions, but we'll say, here's the specific order in which we want you to see them based on our data. You know, try and be as close to this as you can. Write down when you're done and then how long you wait in line. And then on average over time, the difference in the two families is typically around 4 hours. The closest anyone has ever come, one family who we told, you know, do whatever you want, only waited an hour longer than our family in the parks, but they had to break up into individual groups. So it was a family of four. They broke up into individual people and they were running around the park communicating wait times to each other and looking at the lines, and then they would get back together and decide what to ride. I'm not sure that that's a vacation, but you know, God bless him for trying. That's the closest anyone's ever come to even tying a touring flight. Yeah.
So in some ways, this whole concept alleviates, in some ways, both of the first problems we talked about. But let's go back and talk about how you got to where you are. First question, are you a long-time amusement park fan?
Yeah, so I've loved Disney theme parks since my first visit. When, in the 70s, my grandparents moved to Florida, because that was the law back in the United States back then. Your grandparents had to move to Florida when they retired. And so they took me to Disney World when I have a twin sister, when my twin sister and I were young. And I remember, you know, being in line at Pirates of the Caribbean and seeing a light fixture that had a light that would flicker like it was a real candle. And I thought, you know, to myself, you know, somebody cared enough to make that light, which could have just been a regular light, to make it look like a candle. Like, this place is special. So I've been in love with it ever since. And my twin sister and I would go every year for our birthdays as soon as we could drive and, you know, had enough money to go. So that's how I fell in love with the parks.
So you are a self-described nerd. It's a word you use all the time on your podcast. Yep. You got your master's thesis that, and I don't know exactly what it was, but it basically, you were awarded a patent for this. And it was using computer techniques for generating efficient ways to get through a theme park. So that's where it started. Is that right?
Yeah. So I, the summer before I started graduate school, and I went to North Carolina A&T State University. I got to give a shout out to my Aggies. The summer before I started graduate school, I waited in line at Disney World for 2 hours for this ride called the Great Movie Ride. And in the sun. And I can, every time I tell the story, Michael, I can remember two things. One, the sun beating down on my neck. And two, how I smelled at the end of that 2 hours. And let me tell you, that's enough to motivate a lot of people to do a lot of things. So I went back to my thesis advisors and I said, you know, I want to write a computer program where you tell it the rides you want to ride in Disney World, and it tells you the order in which you should ride the rides to minimize your wait in line. And so my thesis advisors had two questions for me. One of them was, is it hard? Like, you know, is this worth a master's thesis? It turns out it's one of the fundamental problems in math and computer science. It's this thing called the traveling salesman problem. And companies like FedEx and UPS are concerned with this kind of problem every day. So my master's thesis expanded on the PhD dissertation of one of UPS's lead research scientists.
What year was this?
So I graduated in 2000. And the other question they had was, besides you, Lynn, does anyone care about this? And I was like, 60 million people go to Walt Disney World every year. Like, this is the number one complaint, you know, waiting in long lines. So, yeah, so both of those things were answered. While I was in school, the university patented my research. I eventually bought the patent back from them. But yeah, and then I turned it into an app and then eventually a company. And that's my full-time job.
That's unbelievable. You know, I am curious. Like, you are an early adapter, right? You foresaw this product with a huge need, as you said. We're like, did your parents say, we want you to go work for the military? Or, you know, were people supportive?
They were. And I got to give a shout out here to the company I was working for at the time. I worked for American Express in technologies. And I loved every minute of that. They were super supportive of me getting a master's degree, even if it didn't directly relate to credit cards. My leadership team, the entire time I was there, was super supportive. And then when I decided, like, so at one point I decided I had to leave American Express if this was going to be big. And my senior vice president at the time, it's their job to talk you out of doing that, to quitting the company. And we got on the call, and I'd actually helped this person with one of their Disney vacations before. And we got on the call and he's like, I know I'm supposed to tell you you're not supposed to go, but you should go. I was like, all right. So yeah, love the entire time working for them. Yeah.
Well, that's nice to hear. Yeah. So you use math and computer science to solve this problem and create this idea of touring plans. Yeah. And I've become in my neighborhood a little bit of like a go-to helper for folks who are going to Disney. And a lot of it just comes from reading the material you've published and then from, you know, my own experience. But one of the things that the touring plans does is you can choose what you want to see, and that's important. And you can choose it. Do you like walking or waiting or what? How you want to prioritize? So how complex is it? I mean, is there a way that someone like me who does not understand how complex is it?
It's very complicated, and the problem grows very, very quickly. So I'll give you an example. And there's a little bit of math involved. Is that okay?
Sure.
All right. Here we go. Let's say you wanted to ride one ride in Walt Disney World. There's only one way to see the one ride. You just walk to it and you're done. If there are two rides, there's two ways to see the rides. Let's call them A and B. First you see A, then you see B, or you see B and A. So there's only two possible ways, right? For three rides, there's six ways you can do it, and I won't go into the numbers. But the short answer is this. If you want to see 10 rides, there's 10 times 9 times 8 times 7 times 6 times 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, different ways in which different touring plans that you can use to see those. So that's 3,628,800 different touring plans. You are not going through that in your head. As I tell my daughter, like, I can keep three things straight in my mind ever since I had kids, right? Like, so you're not doing that. You're not as good as a computer at crunching numbers, and that's what it comes down to.
Are you good at playing craps?
I'm good enough to know that the odds are never in your favor, so I don't play. Like, we do a guide to Las Vegas, and I don't gamble. It's just, you know the odds. So I like to. My quip is that I gambled in love, and I won, and now I quit. So.
That's fair. You've used the data to your touring plan is to avoid all the tables. Yeah. So I love the idea that you've collected all this data to develop these plans. And I do know that the data is not just paper data. It involves sending people to count how many people get on a line or how many buses come in a certain time. Tell us a little bit about the extent you'll go to collect data in person.
All right, so one of the things we have to do to create a good touring plan is to forecast how long you're going to wait in line at every ride in every park every day of the year for the next year, right? So if you want to know what Space Mountain is going to be like, you know, at noon on August 1st, 2025, we've got a forecast out there that makes a prediction. And in order to do that, you've got to collect a lot of data about what's happening in the parks every few minutes. And I have a team of data scientists whose job is to create those models. But one of the things that we do is we have people whose job is to be in the parks every day. And what they're looking for is anomalies. Like, let's say you're walking by a ride like Peter Pan's Flight in the Magic Kingdom. You've been on this, right, Michael?
A million times.
Okay. So you walk by Peter Pan's Flight, and let's say the sign that Disney has out in front of Peter Pan's Flight says the wait time from this point forward is 5 minutes. But you're looking at the line, and the line goes all the way through the ride, out the door, and back, you know, back down the street. Like, there's no way that can be 5 minutes. So one of our staff's job is to jump in that line and time how long you'll actually wait in that line, because we know that the posted wait time is wrong. And this is sort of a larger thing that we do. Every theme park everywhere in the world has incorrect posted wait times for a variety of reasons. And so when we're telling you how long you're going to wait, we want to know how long you're actually going to wait, not how long the sign out front says you're going to wait, because that's often incorrect, again, for a variety of reasons. So that's one of the things that our team does. The other thing that we do a number of things that are kind of crazy, but one of the projects we started in 2012 was to tell you the view you get from every one of Disney's 35,000 hotel rooms. I know. So I got to give some background here. I used to answer all of my own email. And in 2011, I answered 43,000 emails related to the unofficial guide, I answered 12,000 emails. Let me start over. All right. So in 2011, I answered 12,000 emails for the unofficial guide. And like half of them, Michael, were along the lines of, I'm going to this hotel. What room should I request? And obviously, you know, answering that many emails is literally a full-time job. It takes 8 hours a day to answer those emails, especially when you're trying to give the pros and cons of hotel rooms. And you want to give a good answer, right? You got to, these people paid for the book. You got to give them a quality answer. So we decided to write a tool that would do this. And we eventually figured out that it would only take about a month to get photos of the exterior view you get at most of Disney's hotel rooms. And then it took us a year to build building by building, floor by floor, room by room maps of every Disney hotel room. But now on the site, you can go in and say, you know, I'm staying at Caribbean Beach. I want to stay in the Barbados section. What are the best rooms that have two queen beds? You know, and we'll show you all of the rooms, and you can click on an individual room, and we'll show you the view from that room. So, so that's kind of insane as well.
That's completely insane, and you should be taken away. Yeah, I've used this feature, and one of the things that's great about it is that if you are staying in one category of room, you can find the, you know, maybe if you're staying in the standard room, which is Disney's parlance for cheap room, you can find the one with the kind of nice view. And you also have an automated way that you will send a room request to Disney for subscribers of touringplans.com, which is amazing. To go back to what you're talking about before, I was talking to my daughter last night, who's 19 years old, and she's the person I go to Disney with the most. My wife has opted out of going on many of the trips. She still comes sometimes, but it's mostly me and my daughter. Well, that's the thing, is once my daughter became age enough to run, you know, then my wife was left behind, as me and my daughter just went on 35 rides a day. You know, it just becomes this kind of mania.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, and I said to her, what do you want me to ask Len Testa? And she said, well, ask him why Disney does not post the correct time on the rides. And, you know, for instance, our last trip in September, we walked onto the Star Wars, the big ride. We literally walked on. It was zero.
Rise of the Resistance.
Yeah. And you just never know what's going on with those rides. I mean, I guess part of it is just to try to move the crowds around.
So posted wait times, the times that a theme park operator will tell you is the wait, they're wrong for a variety of reasons. The simplest explanation is it's just really hard to keep up with that, right? Mm. If you've got, if you're slammed for a day, and you've only got five people working the ride or four people working the ride, it takes time for someone to walk the line, figure out how long it is, estimate the wait from that, then go update a computer system, right? There's a lot involved. But there are a couple of other reasons too. One is that most theme park operators have found that overstating your wait a little bit leads to greater satisfaction when you actually wait slightly less.
Oh.
So historically, on average, over time, your actual wait in line at a Disney ride is, again, on average over time, about 80% of the posted wait, 80, 82%, something like that. We've found that. So if the posted wait is 60 minutes, you'll really wait like 48. And you'll come out saying, oh, that wasn't so bad. We saved 12 minutes.
That's interesting psychology.
It is. And every theme park does it. Every theme park also occasionally overstates the wait time as a means of crowd control. So your suspicion or your daughter's suspicion there is correct. Like, imagine early in the morning on, you know, the week of Christmas at Space Mountain or Tron or another really popular ride. Even if Disney knows that the wait time is 20 minutes, they're going to post a crazy wait time like 240. And they've done this, by the way. We have internal data that shows that not only did they do it, they knew what the internal wait was at the time. So I'm not just saying this. I know that it's true. But, you know, what they can't do is they can't say, look, Michael, I know the wait's 20 minutes right now, but we would really like it if you went to the opposite end of the park because no one's over there right now and we're trying to distribute crowds evenly throughout the park, right? There's no way that they could say that, and there's no way you would listen, right? So sometimes they inflate the posted waits, and not only Disney, every theme park does it. They sometimes inflate the posted waits as a signal for you to go somewhere else.
I would say on our most recent trip, it was the most wrong that we've ever seen it. It was just, and so we got into a habit of when we would get on a line, we would say to the cast member, do you think this time is accurate? And they almost always said, yeah. If it says 35 minutes, it's going to be 35 minutes. And I think one of those times we waited 12 minutes, you know, so I can't tell if they're being honest or not. I don't know.
I think especially for cast members, the safe answer is always to say yes. because if they say no, when you ask them what it is and they're wrong, then you're going to be mad at them versus being mad at the system.
Yeah.
So that's difficult. What really helps is to, especially for Disney, is just to have experience on when, you know, when lines are supposed to be long, what the line actually looks like compared to the wait time. And that's stuff that you can only get, you know, by going time after time, year after year.
Yeah. I want to point out to folks listening that, you know, we're talking about this insane level of detail and how to save, you know, 4 hours, substantial amount of time or more. But I want to point out that you also point out over and over again that it's okay to not do any of this and to just goof off and have fun.
Yeah, so one of the great things about a Disney vacation, especially if you're a parent, is that you can plan nothing, just show up and still have a great time because, you know, Disney World is essentially a city that's built for fun, right? And what I tell people is, like, compare that to, you know, if you were going to a major city in the United States, like let's say you were going to LA, right? If you went to LA, you, the parents, would have to be responsible for planning the entertainment, the restaurants, the travel details, the transportation for every hour of every day that you're going to be there, right? And you have to make sure that the kids are going to like it and be entertained, and there's places for you to rest and go to the bathroom if you need it, right? Just, it's an incredible level of planning, and any parent with children has done this. But the beauty part about Walt Disney World or Disney Cruise, you know, same thing, is, or a theme park in general, is you show up and someone has already built the entertainment for you. You just have to make choices about what to see. And so that's a lot less planning. Now, the downside is so many people go to theme parks that they overwhelm the capacity of popular rides and restaurants. So you do have to do some planning. But again, you can just show up and have a decent time, which is different than like any other kind of vacation you would have.
Yeah, I do think in my experience, when I hear people who are disappointed, they come back from Disney, did not enjoy themselves.
Yeah.
Often it's because they were expecting something, they did not plan, and they showed up and they were just completely overwhelmed. And I do think that as Disney is evolving, you do need more, at least if you want to, you know, have an efficient, if you want to do a lot of things, yes, you kind of need to plan in advance. Let's talk about cost, because we talked about crowds, and you do provide some cost savings ideas in your work. It's kind of a mixed bag. As far as cost goes, I agree that it's insane. It's especially in the past 10 years.
Yep.
I really do understand why people are so often shocked by the cost, but I'm not so sure it's a bad value. That sticker shock, I think, makes people forget that it still could be, it can be expensive, but still a good value, especially if we use Len's advice and experience a lot more rides. Then it becomes a much better value. You didn't just go on 8 rides, you went on 35, and you know, you can go on a lot of, you can go on a lot of rides, shows, and attractions. And by the way, that's a phrase I've picked up from your podcast, rides, shows, and attractions. Just keep saying it.
Shows and attractions.
Yeah. So the book really helps with both problems. Let me tell you a very quick story. There was a fireman's carnival to raise money for the volunteer firemen in my town. And my daughter was just under 2 years old. We took her over there, and they had a merry-go-round that had, I think, 4 horses hooked up to the back of a, you know, car that they had. And we walked over, and we said, "One, please." And she said, "You have to go over to this booth, you know, 100 yards away and buy a ticket." So we bought a ticket. It was $4. Yeah, and this was 10 years ago. So $4, we get back over there, and the very bored teenager looks at us and says, "Oh, she can't ride alone. You also have to get a ticket." Okay, go back over for a second.
All right.
Get a second ticket, put the kid on the horse, and we go around 10 times while this girl plays a boombox of, like, you know, rap music with curses in it. So, you know, at the end of the day, was that worth $8? Of course it was, right? I wasn't going to tell my 2-year-old no, but it really was a life-changing moment for me, because I think Disney at that point was still probably around $80. So I was thinking, well, would you rather go on this thing 10 times or go to Disneyland, you know? And it really changed. Yeah, it's not a terrible value. There's so much to do.
Yeah, that's the thing. If you compare it to, you know, living in New York, it's comparable to other entertainment you would get, especially for the quality and the duration. You know, for all the times I've complained about Disney and prices,
there is data,
the gold
and then there
standard
is quality
entertainment
research
around the world.
And then there is qualitative research, and I believe.
So I think, yeah, to your point, if you know, if you can amortize that cost over, you know, 20 attractions, you know, per day, it starts to look competitive to amusement parks and fairs and stuff like that. The thing where it falls down, or the thing that kind of drives me crazy, is people who pay more than they have to for the exact same experience, or they pay more than they have to for a subpar experience. And that's really what sort of like the book is about, like saving you time and money or making sure that you get the best value for those things.
Yeah. There is data and then there is qualitative research. And I believe you have stayed in every Disney hotel, experienced every ride, and eaten at every Disney restaurant and food cart. First of all, that is your, again, yeah. That's pretty wild. How many hotel rooms are there in Disney World?
I mean, considering the all of Walt Disney World property, there's probably close to 35,000.
And how many hotels?
It's, yeah, depending on how you count, like spin-offs, somewhere between 28 and 34, I believe. I'd have to get an exact count, yeah.
So how many days of your
between
life
two and three dozen.
Have you spent in a Disney park? Have you set foot in, I mean, over 1,000? Is that possible?
I calculated it once that by the time I hit 50, I'd spent 2% of my life in a Disney theme park. So, I mean, and I live in Celebration, Florida half the year. So I'm 6 minutes from the parks. So I basically go every day then. I'm sure it's in the thousands at this point. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sure. This was the first trip last September that I went with my daughter where we decided to slow it down a little bit. We bought Park Hopper and we bought the water park thing. We went to the water park 3 times, mostly just to go in the middle of the day and swim. And we also did something we had never done before, which is we ate in resorts. We visited 3 of the deluxe resorts. We had never set foot in any deluxe resort before. And I was amazed what percent of Disney properties are deluxe. It kind of blows. Yeah. I'm looking around at these people and thought, well, they don't look, you know, like they founded Microsoft. Like, who are these people? Are they just saving their money for years? Are people just richer than I can imagine? Because there's so many deluxe rooms and the upper, tell us a little bit about what the upper limit of spending on rooms, or just what the normal deluxe costs and what the upper limit is of dining and of staying in a Disney property.
Disney has 3 categories of hotels, or 4 if you count their timeshare. Value, moderate, deluxe, and then their timeshare is called the Disney Vacation Club. So within the deluxe category, the hotel rooms are typically not only larger and more well-appointed than the other hotels, they're also closer to a park. Like there are deluxe hotels like the Grand Floridian or the Contemporary or the Polynesian that are literally walking distance to the Magic Kingdom. And that's a huge benefit for a lot of people. But those rooms will typically run anywhere from $600 to $1,200 a night, depending on where you're going to, you know, when you're going. It's slightly less expensive for deluxe hotels that aren't near the Magic Kingdom, but still you would expect to pay, you know, rack rates somewhere between $400 and $700 a night for a deluxe hotel at Disney World. So it is a lot. Disney definitely targets the top 20% of American households by income when it comes to its theme parks.
And what's the most expensive rooms and meals cost?
The most expensive rooms are probably going to be at the Grand Floridian Hotel, which is considered their flagship. And, you know, a suite there will probably run you, you know, $2,500 a night easy. Maybe even more than that now. I don't stay at those very often, Michael, so I'm not great on the prices. But, you know, figure between $2,000 and $4,000 a night for those. For the restaurants, Disney has a Michelin-starred restaurant called Victoria and Albert's. It got 1 Michelin star this year. I think it deserves 2, just based on my dining experience in New York. So I'd expect them to get 2 sometime soon. It is impeccable service. The staff there are the best restaurant staff I've ever encountered on a regular basis. A meal there, you can probably assume, is going to run $500 to $700 per person, you know, with gratuity and wine and stuff like that. It is definitely something that I, in context, again, and I've eaten at a number of Michelin-starred restaurants in New York and Vegas and elsewhere. In context, that is an appropriate price for the experience that you get there. But one step down from that, a ballpark is like $100 to $120 per person with dinner, a drink, and dessert. You know, that's roughly it for Disney World. Let me put it this way. If you live in New York and you go out to eat, you will not be shocked by Disney prices. Mm-hmm. If you come from other parts of the country, you will be. And this is actually research we've done. We survey our readers and our users after their trip to Walt Disney World about things like the restaurants they ate at, the rides they rode, and the hotels they stayed at. And we've got more than a million restaurant surveys just from Walt Disney World, like an astounding number of surveys. And one of the things that we've determined is the size of the city that you're from has a little bit of influence on how you rate a Disney restaurant. And so, like, I'll give you an example. In Epcot, there's this Japanese restaurant called Takumite, which is high-end Japanese omakase menus, and it's a very seasonal presentation. And it's $250 per person. But my favorite sushi place in the city on 72nd, a place called Sushi Kaito, if I can give a shout-out to them, it runs about $140 per person just for omakase, not for the seasonal menu. And so in the context of that, the Disney thing is absolutely appropriate for what it is. But if you're coming from some place that doesn't have omakase or that doesn't have, you know, seasonal Japanese menus, and you're only used to like hibachi dining, you would think that that is an insane amount of money for the food that you're getting. So it depends on what you're familiar with. And that really is kind of tied to the city you come from.
Well, I kind of describe it as like when you're in the airport and you want water and it's $4.50 and you buy it because, you know, you're thirsty. And you're and with Disney, you're just kind of stuck in the airport for a week or whatever. You know, just it's just the way
it is.
It's going to be.
It is. It's expensive. It's New York prices. But from, you know, imagine you don't live in New York and you're not used to that. The other thing I would say is generally the food is very consistent. Like very little of it is actually bad. Most of it is at least good, if not better than that. Like I think the average satisfaction rating we get for all Disney restaurants is like 87-88%, and which, you know, that's a solid B plus no matter how you look at it. So.
Yeah. Over the years, I have returned the survey myself many times, and I have seen my quotes in the book and on the website. New Jersey Dad says this. And one of the quotes that I said, this will definitely make it, but it did not. But I want to say it on the podcast today because I want people to know it, is that Disney is one of the best places to return food if it's bad. You know, if you take a bite of something and it's not worth the slight, you know, an $8 cookie better be really good. And if you take a bite and it's stale or it's, you know, they're just going to friendly return it with ease.
No questions. Yep. Yeah. Nope. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. They want you to be happy. And the margins, the margins are good enough for those things that they can make you another one. It's absolutely fine.
Sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm not worried about Disney's margins.
Exactly. Yeah, but they really are great at customer service.
To close out money, I think I heard on your podcast recently that one of the things is listening to the podcast really sheds light on the Disney decision-making process. And it really does seem in a disturbing way that it always, to some extent, is about money. Every single decision, outside of creating rides, is somehow tied to some money idea. But I believe that recently you guys said that the number of visitors are down, but the total dollars is up. So does Disney understand what the cost is of when weighing out value that, you know, people who are, instead of saying, let's go back, you know, every 12 months, they're going to switch that to every 18 months or every 24 months, are people who get home and complain about the $8 cookie. Do they understand that that has a cost too?
They do. And I think this is where, over the last couple of years, they probably pushed pricing a little bit beyond what the market could bear. So let me just give an example here. Disney only cares about total revenue, right? They're one of the few U.S. companies who still believes in or still follows the shareholder value model of operation, right? So all they care about is stock price and revenue. And so for Disney, they could say, you know, for Disney, it's the same if they get 100 people paying $100 each to get in the park, or they get 50 people paying $200 because the revenue is the same, right? And so what Disney's been doing over the last few years is increasing the prices so that they still make more revenue, even if the number of people in the parks is smaller. So in our example, you know, they could 50 people at $200 is the same as 100 people at $100. But 25 people at $400 is still the same amount of money. And 25 people at $500 is more, right? Mm. And so they're perfectly willing to trade the number of people in the parks for higher revenue. But where they've run into problems is this. Eventually, you price a Disney vacation so high that now you're competing with things like Europe, right? Like we can go to Europe, right? And for the same amount of money as going to Orlando. And so the question is if you're thinking about, you know, making memories with your kids, which is going to be the more memorable trip? And I think that's where they ran into, you know, problems over the last a couple of years. And I think, you know, CEO Bob Iger has said, you know, they may have pushed prices beyond what they should have. So they're recognizing that. Yeah.
It's very interesting because there is, I mean, I can't think of any other example where the law of supply and demand is so hard to understand. You know, people will wait 3 hours to go on a ride, which just is a crazy idea. I mean, I've done it myself.
Yeah.
I know that you have some non-Disney business in the medical field that you are developing, and what I'm going to ask you now is really none of my business, so feel free to say, Michael, this is none of my business.
Good.
But are you choosing...
I'm happy to talk about it.
Are you choosing this travel work, which I'm sure you're fairly compensated, but I guess my theory is that you've chosen to sort of use your superpowers for good instead of, you know, working for American Express or some corporate client who might pay more. Am I right that in your life you have chosen to maybe make slightly less money to do touring plans work?
No, I make more. Let's put it this way: I have a very comfortable life.
Okay,
and not for nothing, Disney put my kid through the complications of a Disney trip. Put my kid through graduate school, right? Mm-hmm. But here's the thing: I look at saving people time and money at a theme park as a valuable use of the God-given talents I've been given, whatever they are, right? However small they are, and really. Like helping people is sort of the things I look for when I look at potential work that I could be doing. And a lot of people, you know, everyone has their own sort of criteria for things like that. I am lucky enough that I can pick and choose projects by being halfway decent as a computer scientist. So the other thing that I'm working on is clinical decision support software, because it kind of fits in my field of, not to be nerdy, but combinatorial optimization. Really big problems that it's really difficult to find an exact solution for. So I've started working with that. It's also a nice diversification beyond theme parks. You know, sort of like the thing we learned from the pandemic is, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket. So.
Hmm. One of the things that you talk about a lot on the podcast almost every week is leaked surveys. Disney sends out tons and tons and tons of surveys to their visitors, and then they take screenshots and send those to you. And one of the things that it reveals is sort of how devious Disney is. I mean, their data, I'm sure you would love to get to see whatever, to have access to their data.
Yeah. So the surveys are great, both Disney and Universal surveys, for a couple of reasons. One is Universal puts at the beginning of their surveys this little disclaimer that says, by taking this survey, you promise not to share it with anyone. I'm like, okay, that sounds legal to me. Like, God forbid I send this to Led. But the other thing is that sometimes they'll ask a survey for generally one of two reasons: to gauge an idea that they're thinking about, like, would this be a good thing if we did it? Or we made a decision, it's not going the way we thought. Tell us why it's not going the way we thought, right? So one of the surveys that Disney sent out after they started, you know, changing their reservation system and charging money for things was basically, how much do you hate each of these new changes? And I'm sure they got an earful on that. So like one of them, for example, was pre-pandemic, you used to be able to make ride reservations up to 60 days in advance, kind of like a restaurant reservation, right? You could make a reservation to say, I want to ride Space Mountain at noon on, you know, Tuesday, 2 months from now when I'm arriving at the parks. And coming out of the pandemic, you could only do that starting at 7 a.m. on the day of your visit, which means on your vacation, you had to get up like at 6:30 to be on your computer with enough coffee to be able to do what you want. And people hated that, right? It's no one wants to get up that early on vacation. So the surveys told them that that was one of the things that people really disliked about the changes, and they changed it this year. So that's good. But sometimes they're also looking for justification or direction for projects they might do. And I'll give you an example. Universal Orlando recently sent out a survey asking you what you thought about a bunch of different movie franchises, right? So everything from, you know, the new Minions movies to, you know, older movies like Twister, the original version of Twister, the Tornado movie, or Back to the Future. And if you looked at the movie franchises, you could kind of break it down into multiple categories. Like one category is, these are films that already have rides in the Universal parks, right? And then another one would be movies that have sequels coming out in the next year that might also be potential rides. And when you started crossing off the list of, like, you know, they've done that, they might do this, they've already done this and it didn't work, you were left, the only franchise that was left on that list after you crossed off everything else was Back to the Future. And so the question I had, Michael, was, why do they care about a 40-year-old franchise right now? And it turns out they're exploring bringing Back to the Future back to the parks. It's one of those things where you can sort of deduce from the question where they're going with things or the ideas that they're testing out. So that's always super fun.
Yeah, it's a... Right, you kind of have to read between the lines. I want to talk about this.
Exactly. Yeah.
Sort of a bigger idea, you know, which is, what does Disney parks, you know, why do people love it so much? You know, it's just, there is like a really deep connection to this.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's people that don't get it also, but I mean, just in a nutshell, why do you think people need it, love it so much?
I mean, a couple of reasons. One is, you know, like I said before, it's a city built for fun. Walt Disney World, and to some extent, you know, Disneyland, is purpose built for entertainment and the environments that you're in there. So if you think about like the Magic Kingdom, you think about like Main Street USA or Adventureland or you know, Fantasyland, the immersive nature of those lands are really unparalleled in themed entertainment. It's like being in a movie. They do an excellent job at recruiting cast members, you know, their employees who buy into that and who provide excellent service. And they have generally built the best large theme park rides in the world. Like them and Universal combined are really the top two. We're basically, you know, the United States and China at the Olympics, right? The two countries that are going to dominate, you know, the discussion in almost any event that they put their minds to. So, you know, the things at their peak, the things that they do better than anyone. And you know, that brings a lot of nostalgia to a lot of people. Like, I mean, you've had, you know, your daughter probably has extremely fond memories of her trips with you. So, you know, and that gets passed down from generation to generation. You know, that's one of the things that I kind of worry about when I look at how much it costs for a Disney vacation. Like, you know, 40 years ago, a middle-class family like mine could afford at least, you know, one or two days in Disney World a year. And for a lot of Americans, right, a lot of Americans share fond memories of a Disney theme park. But, you know, over time, when you start saying, well, you know, this is really for the top 20% of American households, and really it's for the top 10%, you know, you kind of lose that sort of shared collective appreciation of a Disney theme park. Or as I like to tell people, like, I want to be able to walk up to someone in Nebraska, you know, get in a car, go up a mountain, and while I'm in the car with them, say, ooh, Space Mountain. And I want them to be able to understand that joke. And if they don't, like, we've lost something as a country. So that's kind of the thing I'm worried about with the prices, right? The lack of shared social experience.
And it does make me think, and I know this is slightly corny, but what would Walt Disney think? You know, what do you think he would think?
You know, the first thing I think he would be like, you know, this is my frozen head, where's the rest of my body, if you were alive today?
Of course.
But, you know, two things. You know, Walt was a businessman. He understood, you know, the importance of making money. He really didn't live long enough to see the explosion in popularity of Disney theme parks. So it's hard to say, you know, how he would have gone. I will say this: the people that built Disneyland and Walt Disney World and then Epcot Center gambled the company essentially three times when building those things and won. And I don't think current management would make those same bets because shareholders probably wouldn't let them. It was a different time back then. I will say this too, you know, there were years where Walt kept prices exactly the same year over year because he wanted to ensure that people had value. And I don't think that's something that it would be possible in the current environment either. So,
yeah. So, I mean, this idea of waking up at 7 a.m. and having to, yeah. Are we, this path is here to stay for at least for as long as you can see?
Oh, yeah, rising prices, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think they're nearing the limit in some ways, but there's always ways that they can make more money. And I think they're always testing stuff like that. Like, I am 100% certain that it's somebody's job in Walt Disney World to determine the perfect price for hot dogs and hamburgers. Like, I honestly believe that's true, not joking. And they're a fantastic analytical organization, so they'll keep doing that. I think you know, the thing that their challenge over the next 5 and 10 years is to keep up with not only, you know, Universal, which is opening Epic Universe next year, but also to be compelling in a world full of choices at those price points. And so that's their big thing, right? To be relevant to the audience that has that kind of discretionary income to spend. I think that's their big thing.
How much do you think your work moves the needle, both in terms of visitor behavior and in terms of Disney planning and policy?
So we think that on a given day, somewhere between 1% and 4% of the people in the parks are using the book or the website, which is an astounding number. It's basically the same equivalent share that McDonald's has in the U.S. beef industry, which is pretty big. So that's very big for a third party company that, you know, is basically a bunch of guys running around, men and women running around the theme parks. Right? That's a lot. Yeah. Over the years, I'm not going to say that we've had influence with Disney, but it's awfully coincidental sometimes when we note something and then it gets changed later. Like, I'll give you an example. And one year when I was staying at every Disney hotel, I noticed that they were using the same 120 count bed sheets at their cheap resorts and their deluxe resorts. And so I mentioned it in the book, like, that's weird, right? 120 thread count sheets. And everyone else at the time, like the Hiltons, the, you know, Marriott's, the Four Seasons, they were using 300 thread count and above. And so I put this in the book, and the next year Disney started putting better thread count sheets at deluxe resorts. I know for a fact that they read the book and they listen to the podcast and, you know, that different organizations. I have contacts throughout the company. There are many people in the company who are deeply appreciative of the kinds of questions that we ask. And I think I actually say this in the book that, you know, there are people that love us inside Disney, but from afar. So I'm satisfied that if I have a legitimate complaint or a legitimate concern, that someone is listening on the other end, even if they can't acknowledge it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. The gross.
And I have many off the record stories.
That's clear. That is very clear from to podcast listeners.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff I can't talk about, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. The gross of the parks is pretty easy to find out, but I find that number is so large that it's almost not impressive. It's just a bomb that goes off. I think it's more impressive if we break it down. I think I heard you say recently there's about 60,000 visitors on an average day. Do we know what the average spend per person is?
I mean, you could just divide revenue by that. I don't have that number, but there are a couple of interesting things around that I can tell you. Like, one thing we've seen recently is this. So everyone has a budget for their trip, right? Even wealthy households have sort of a budget. And when you're bumping up against the limit of that budget, you have to start making decisions about where you spend your money, right? So some of that money you have to spend on hotels and tickets. Like, that's non-negotiable, right? You have to sleep somewhere at night, you have to get to the parks. But some of the money is discretionary, like the amount of money that you would spend at a sit-down restaurant. And one of the things that we've been seeing in the parks is that people are eating fewer sit-down meals at the restaurants and taking that money from their budget and reallocating it towards the line-skipping services like Lightning Lane, which is interesting for a variety of reasons. One is it tells you what people really prioritize on their vacation, in this case, saving time over good meals. But number two, it also tells you that Disney's probably hit the value limit for their restaurant pricing, but hasn't hit the value limit for their line skipping programs.
Oh.
And that's really interesting to me. And so if you're Disney, going back to your question about net, Disney's net profit on line skipping programs is almost 100%. It's like 99.75%. Because once you build the computer systems, it doesn't cost you anything, right? But for restaurants, like, and I know there are a ton of people listening in the restaurant industry, so I could get this number wrong, but my understanding is that a meal at Disney, the ingredients and the labor to produce the food can't generally be more than 25% of the cost of the meal to the guest. So if a meal costs you $100, $25 of that is the food itself and the preparation of it. And I'm sure some of it has to go to like overhead of the restaurant and things like that. But to tell you what the margins are, like the margins on line skipping services are basically 100%. And the margins on restaurants are much less. So Disney's actually probably okay with that shift, but it's still interesting from a consumer and from a financial perspective.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see what the boomerang from, you know, what their response will be. They will raise or lower the prices of one or the other. One of the things I want
to point
out is that you are critical of Disney. It seems like with no holding back. I assume that's an interesting tightrope for you to walk. You want to be welcome there, but you also want your listeners' respect, you know. So that's and one of the things on the podcast, the Disney Dish, you guys use patents and building permits as a clue to what's coming. I think that's so fascinating. Also, Jim, your co-host, is very tuned in. I mean, there's clearly a network of spies. And by the way, 500 episodes, congratulations.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, so we have a very good sort of internal team of people who look at public records. And also, you know, over time, we've established a network of people who will give us a heads up, like when Disney files a construction permit or Universal files a construction permit or a patent or something like that. That's always useful to know. So we're able to know some things ahead of time, but we're still, you know, occasionally surprised. Like when Disney, at its recent fan event D23, when they announced four new cruise ships, like I called up my contacts, you know, at the cruise line. I'm like, did you know anything about this? And everyone I talked to said, man, we walked into the office this morning and no one knew what was going on. So, you know, Disney has the ability to keep some things very, very, very quiet, you know, and then, you know, other stuff, you know, leaks like a sieve. So,
yeah, it is surprising that they can keep a secret. Let's talk about the music, the use of music in the parks. They do such an incredible job of putting the right music.
Oh, God,
yeah. Yeah, and it's almost a seamless, you don't even know it, but it's such an important part of making you feel that you're in a place.
Yeah, anyone who's heard, you know, It's a Small World has that song indelibly stuck in their head. And Disney theme park music is, you know, for theme park fans, is some of the best memories that they have. And it's also something that you can play, like, you know, could take home with you, and it's free, right? There's a set of official, you know, Disney theme park albums that Disney puts out. And then, you know, there's obviously, you know, a fan community that circulates stuff as well. My good friend, Mike Newell, ran this website called Mouse World Radio for a long time. And I thought I had a decent collection of Disney theme park audio. Like I had, you know, 20 hours of audio that I'd collected from various sources over the years. And when I knew Mike, he was like, I think I've got something like 2,000 hours of, like, he's got like every ride audio from every ride, like alternate takes of stuff that didn't make it into the Haunted Mansion, just incredible stuff. So collecting music is really, really good. And that's how I got to go to the Buddy Baker archives at NYU.
Right, which on your I did not know about that, but yeah, folks should check that out.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. He wrote just hours and hours of music for all kinds of backgrounds of stuff. There's a thing called the Rock and Roller Coaster in one of the Disney parks, and
yep.
It features the band Aerosmith, who I'm not a huge fan of. And there's always been this rumor that they are going to switch out Aerosmith for another band. Is that real?
Mm. So I know the original agreement in 89 was for 20 years with, I believe, 10-year renewals or 5-year renewals. So we're at the point now where I believe the agreement is, if not year to year, something close to that. And you've got to look at it from Disney's perspective. You know, Aerosmith is retired from touring. I don't think they're going to make any more albums. You know, and it, you get to the point where their heyday was 40 years ago. And at some point, they stopped being relevant to the generation of new parents who are in the parks. So they need to come up with either a different band or a different idea for the ride. So, you know, among my friends, it's always been an interesting question, like, you know, what American band should replace Aerosmith in Rock and Roller Coaster? And as far as I can tell, it's Foo Fighters.
Oh, it should be Taylor Swift. I'll just tell you right now, if you want to have a line, you know,
I mean,
out the park.
Yeah. I mean, Taylor Swift is the obvious one, and Taylor Swift is basically our generation's Beatles, right? She's immensely talented, immensely popular, and she's very, very good at what she does. I don't know that I would necessarily call her rock. Yeah, and Disney really likes the name Rock and Roller Coaster. They actually went out and purchased the trademark for that name specifically to use it. So that's a valuable asset to them. The only way that they would drop that name is if they went in a completely different direction with the ride.
Interesting.
So it's an interesting question. Like, American rock bands that would qualify for Rock and Roller Coaster. Yeah,
but I think they also it also has to be a band that appeals to people who are under 25. You know, and I don't know who that is at this point.
Mm. You know? Yeah, I think the demographic is more like, for them, it's more like 35 to 44. But yeah, to your point, I mean, those 25-year-olds will in 10 years be 35.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. So I mean, rock bands that appeal to 25-year-olds. I don't know.
That will still have relevancy, I mean, you know, 25 years from now. Yeah, it's an impossible.
And it's funny because, like, I mean, your daughter's 19, my daughter's 26, but the concerts that we've been to recently, because my daughter and I love go to concerts, it's been Lana Del Rey, The Weeknd, and Stevie Nicks. Like, and none of those I would say would be, you know, qualify for a Rock and Roller Coaster. Stevie Nicks definitely would, but not in that demographic. Maybe in that demographic, Steve.
Think
Nicks
of the cocaine snow cone they could sell, or, you know, at the to tie in with the
Phoenix. One section of the ride could be called Deviated Septum, you know, where it's just like blood exactly. in her nose from cocaine. Yeah, exactly.
Sounds great.
And I say that with love. I love Stevie Nicks.
I
have nothing wrong with Stevie Nicks. I love her.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
Let's talk. Am I right that you guys used a boombox playing The Who's "Won't Be Fooled Again" to stand outside of hotel doors, and then you would put like a calibration device on the pillow to see how loud it was? Is that a true story?
It is 100% true. So one of the things that we do with Disney hotel rooms is we test the soundproof quality, because noise in the hotel rooms is one of the big complaints that people have. And so when we're testing that noise, we have to have a way of quantifying how good the soundproofing is. And so the idea is that you want to generate a consistent noise and then use a sound meter inside the hotel room to see how loud the sound is. And so we were coming up with ideas one day, and originally we thought, well, we'll just generate a constant tone, like a G note at 70 decibels. And it turns out that people think that's an air raid siren, and it scares everyone. So you don't do that. Like, that's a bad idea to generate a constant tone at 70 decibels. People think something's wrong. So you don't do that in a hotel. And so what we decided to do to sort of blend into the environment is we would play a song at 70 decibels. So we got a boombox. I got to pick the music, and I picked The Who's "Won't Get Fooled Again." And so you turn up the volume on the boombox until the very beginning, when Roger Daltrey is screaming, it hits exactly 70 decibels on your sound meter. And then you take the boombox outside, you keep the sound meter inside, and you put it on the bed's pillow where your head would be, because that's where your ears are going to be, right? And then you play the same music and record the soundproofing. And then sometimes we'll actually get adjoining hotel rooms and do the same thing, putting the boombox in the room next door. so that we can hear how good the soundproofing is between the rooms. Yeah. And so you can, that's actually works really, really well. It's pretty consistent. You can play the, you can adjust the levels and stuff like that. We do the same thing with when we measure light in the room. Like if you have to work in a hotel room, you want it to be a certain level of brightness. But also like when you're in the bathrooms getting ready in the morning, if you've got dark hair, you need more light to see the hair, stuff like that. So we quantify light quality. We do soundproofing. We even once measured the fluffiness of the pillows, because that drove me crazy. Here's a fun tip. Don't ever try to bring a replica of a human head through TSA, because they have so many questions, Michael. So many questions. Yeah. But then we realized that a gallon of water weighs about the same, and that's way easier to get through security. Yeah.
Well, you know what? One of the things I find so interesting is that you are using data to solve emotional problems, or emotional-based questions.
Yeah, I mean, to the extent that you can quantify things like, how noisy is this or how bright is this and stuff like that, those are real concerns that people have. And, everyone's noise tolerance is different. A little bit of background noise might be fine for some people, but it might be completely annoying for others. Mm-hmm. So for us to say, here's a list of the quietest hotel rooms, or here's the location of the quietest hotel rooms, that's the best we can do in that circumstance. Like, if this is really a concern for you, these are your choices. So yeah, it's fun research too. It keeps everybody on their toes.
Yeah. Well, do you have strong feelings about the new Country Bear Jamboree? Because it kind of leads into I think Disney is sort of headed in the wrong direction attraction-wise, and to me this is, I understand why they're doing it, but to me this is a perfectly nice show. I just what it means to me is bad news.
Yeah, so let me give you some background. So the old show, Country Bear Jamboree, was for years this bunch of mechanical robot bears who would sing obscure, corny, actual country music songs. Like songs that were popular for like 10 minutes in the 1970s when Disney World was being built. These mechanical bears would sing on stage. And it was, Disney didn't change the attraction for decades. And it became kind of a running joke among people that, like, you'd bring your kids in because you had fond memories of the show, but you'd come out of it and your kids would think that you've got creeping senility, because, like, why would anyone like this, right? And so then Disney changed it this year, and so then now the bears sing Disney songs, right? And I realize what I'm about to say here, Michael, is it's going to sound like a grown man who lives in his mother's basement and has nothing better to do. So forgive me, because I am self-aware of how this sounds. First of all, Disney songs like the song from Aladdin, A Whole New World, doesn't make sense in the context of Frontierland, which is where the ride exists, right? So Frontierland's supposed to be about the American wilderness, and a song about flying above the Middle East doesn't make sense in this context. It doesn't make it. I get why Disney did it, right? They don't have to pay royalties, right? Maybe their ASCAP licensing went down by, $500 a year. Maybe they saved that, whatever. God bless them. But the other thing is, like, the songs that used to be played were actual country music songs played by actual country musicians, some of which are in the Country Music Hall of Fame, right? So to replace that with songs from movies or, TV shows that don't have anything to do with country music or Frontierland, it kind of ruins the theming a little bit. And again, I realize the world has larger problems than this, but the differentiator between Disney and like a Six Flags is theming. And when that, every time that theming is compromised, you lose a little bit of value. That's kind of where I'm going with on that.
Yeah, yeah. You and I are 100% on the same page of this, and you do a great job of talking about the parks, where we are in time, and do what things go together, and why this is next to this thing, and why and how Epcot is just kind of falling apart in terms of there is no theme of that anymore. They're about to rip out the Rivers of America and Tom Sawyer Island. I don't know how, we were out there, and there was nobody out there, basically. I guess kids are just not that interested in going out there. But is that the best? Is there some more to that story?
There is. So the big change is this. In the Magic Kingdom, sort of on the left-hand side of the park, the middle left-hand side, sort of the 9 o'clock position, if you will, is an area of land called Liberty Square. And that includes this thing called the Rivers of America, which is a paddle ship boat ride around Tom Sawyer Island, which is a place you can actually go to with caves and forts and windmills and stuff like that. But also it includes, Liberty Square includes the Haunted Mansion and Hall of Presidents. And so Disney announced that they're getting rid of the Rivers of America and Tom Sawyer Island and replacing it with a outdoor road racing adventure based on the Cars franchise. So a couple of things here. You asked earlier, you know, what Walt would think about all this. I think Walt would actually be fine with ripping out an entire section of the park because he did it previously. The interesting thing from this perspective is it makes sense, I think, from a theme park context and also a business decision. So the business part is easy. None of the rides that are currently there, nothing that's currently there that's going to get ripped out, is making Disney any money. And when they put in a Cars attraction, it's going to make them a ton of money. Like if you told me it would make them $50 million a year in selling ride reservations, I would totally believe that. And the reason why I say that is there's a similar ride out in California that is one of the highest rated and most popular rides in Disneyland Park, like the resort itself. So they're bringing that here. Also, just from a financial perspective, if you look at all of the franchises that Disney owns, Cars is by far the highest grossing franchise that does not have a dedicated ride in Walt Disney World. Like among all the rides that they could build, Cars, I think the Cars franchise, last time I checked, was worth, had sold like $22 billion worth of tickets and merch. And for it not to have a ride in Walt Disney World is kind of crazy, right?
That's wild. So let's talk about bloggers for a moment. Like, I have realized recently that there are really an unbelievable number of Disney bloggers. Yeah. Who, they are obsessive. They make some serious judgments and take things deeply personally. It is like... It's really important to their lives. Some of them are delusional. Some of them are smart. It's really all over the map. Do these people come in contact with you? What do you think is going on there?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's for as many people as there are who make a living sort of reviewing theme parks, it's still a relatively small community. So. I like to think that most of us get along, and I think we do. Like the vast majority of us, will absolutely call up people and have lunch or dinner. Right? That's good. The interesting thing for me was, how the internet sort of changed travel guides. One of the big accomplishments of the unofficial guide is that it has remained relevant in the era of the internet, where the vast majority of travel books have not, because you can go online and get that information. And that's, some of that is healthy, right? Before the internet, travel guides were basically written by people who could afford the time and the money to travel, which generally meant old white people. And now we have a diversity of voices, and that's, unambiguously a good thing. The challenge is that the economics of blogging are such that ad revenue drives income in blogging. And the way to make money in ads is by showing more ads. And the way to show more ads is to say more sensational things to get people to read your blog. So if you're familiar with the term clickbait, that is a proven technique for people to make more money with blogs. And for some people, that temptation is unavoidable. Mm-hmm. I think that's the downside. But in general, I think the vast majority of people do a great job, in covering the parks from diverse angles. It's like anything, 80% of the people are absolutely great at what they do and fine and upstanding citizens. And there's a couple percent that, give everybody else a bad name. So, and God bless them. I mean, they're people that have figured out, ways to, if that's what you have to do to make a living, who am I to judge? So.
Yeah, well, if you're interested in what snack to eat, there are 5,000 videos of people, you know, the top 10 snacks. There's literally 1,000 videos. But you're right, some of them have clickbait, you know, the top snack Disney does not want you to know exists, you know.
This is one of the things that Cory Doctorow, do you know who Cory is?
Mm-mm.
Cory's a science fiction writer, but he also is like one of the leading lights in sort of like culture of the internet thing, and he's coined this term, and you'll forgive me for using it, but it's called inshitification. And it's where you the internet gets flooded with low value clickbaity content to generate ad revenue, and there's so much of it that it's hard to find the good stuff. So if you think about how Google search has gotten worse over the years, this is an example of that. Shout out to Cory. So yeah, but I mean, again, in general, the people that most people that I know are obsessive like me about a specific area of a theme park, and cover it really, really well. So, you know, again, most people are great.
Sure, it's an interesting landscape, and you are a very very kind person. Let's talk about biggest mistakes. I would say, you know, for me, like just off the top of my head, and I don't have the depth of knowledge you have, not getting the Harry Potter franchise into the parks and not buying Knott's Berry Farm are two of the biggest Disney mistakes. What do you think are big Disney mistakes over their history?
Oh, I think, yeah, the Harry Potter thing is interesting for two reasons. So they had they passed on the opportunity to license the Harry Potter franchise from J.K. Rowling because they didn't want to give up that level of creative control. And so as an example, one of the things that J.K. Rowling said to Universal was, there is no Coca-Cola in the Harry Potter franchise, therefore there will not be Coca-Cola in the Harry Potter lands. And Universal was like, whatever you say. And Disney would not do that. So they passed on that. The, you know, for them, the, I think the big question, I don't know if it's necessarily a mistake yet, but the big gamble that they're making right now is that every attraction that they build has to be tied to a movie or TV franchise. So if you think about the classic Disney attractions, things like Pirates of the Caribbean, Haunted Mansion, It's a Small World, you know, Big Thunder Mountain, things like that, none of those were based on a movie or TV franchise. They eventually became movie and TV franchises, but they did not start that way. And so, you know, when you build an attraction in Epcot's future world that is dedicated to the Guardians of the Galaxy movie franchise, I get that that will boost attendance in Epcot for the next, you know, 5-10 years, whatever. Is that something that is going to make sense in 20 years or 30 years, right? And so, you know, someone who's been a fan of the theme parks for, you know, for 40 years, that sort of time scale is what I'm thinking of. And I think management is incented to think of the next quarter, the next year, and not about 40 years down the road. That's going to be some other management's problem. Mm-hmm. So that's a big gamble that they have right now. And I don't know how that's going to play out, right? Especially given that the financials of building a big ride like that means you're on a 20 or 30 year depreciation cycle. It would be really hard to change course after 5 or 10 years, even if people don't like it. The other interesting gamble that they're sort of stuck with is being based in Florida for Walt Disney World. So for a number of years, you know, we've seen a decrease in visitors during summer because nobody with any sense wants to go to Central Florida in the middle of July. You've been there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like 95 degrees with 80% humidity, right? So if you think about how, so let me just put that in context. When a weather person says it's 95 degrees outside, they're measuring that in the shade, right? That's how temperatures are measured, in the shade. So if you're in the sun, it's hotter. And if you're wearing dark clothes, it's hotter still. And if you're on pavement that absorbs heat, it's even hotter than that. So as an example, we've brought, you know, those little radar guns, they're laser guns that you use to measure the temperature of meat on your barbecue. You've seen those?
Sure.
We've measured the heat on the pavement and on benches in Walt Disney World in July. and it could be 125 to 128 degrees on the pavement. You can actually get heat rash on your calves from the heat coming off the pavement. And imagine, you know, kids in strollers, which are closer to the ground, right? The heat is more of a concern for them. So when the weather says it's 95 degrees, you're like, yeah, I can handle 95 degrees. It's really like 120, right? And you know, meteorologists will tell us that this year's summer is the coolest summer we're ever going to experience for the rest of our lives. So, you know, 20 years from now, how do you handle that level of heat in the summer, right? That's a big question as well. And you've seen Disney start to address this with things like the thing they recently put in Epcot called Journey of Water, inspired by Moana. That is basically a walkthrough misting area, which does a couple of things. One, it tells you about the water cycle, like how water goes from lakes and ponds up to clouds and then comes back down as rain. And that really fits in sort of Epcot's educational message. But also, it's a great place to cool off. And so I think that is one initial step at them addressing the idea of how climate change are going to affect their parks. And that's also another big sort of, I'm not saying it's a mistake, it's their big challenge, right?
I think, if I'm not mistaken, you were talking about on a recent podcast how Universal's looking to buy some land in Europe, and they're looking much far north than you would expect because they are counting on the world getting much warmer, which is an incredibly depressing concept. They're looking at where it's going to be. You know, it's serious. It's horrible. So Disney World is twice the size of Manhattan, right? There's all those hotels we talked about. There's two water parks. There's a huge shopping village mall. There's golf courses. There's, you know, it's an incredible. It's bigger than I think most people understand. Can you think of any data, any numbers that can sort of describe the scale that people listening might be surprised by or might not have a grasp on?
Yeah, so it's 28,000 square acres. It's twice the size of Manhattan or about the size of San Francisco. Just Disney World's internal bus system is the third largest bus system in Florida. Only Miami and Jacksonville run more buses. On a typical day, the population of Walt Disney World will be at a minimum, like, you know, slowest day of the year, probably around 125,000 people. And at its peak, it's probably like 350, 375. It's basically Scottsdale, Arizona, or Omaha, Nebraska, you know, somewhere in that range. You know, the transportation network is amazing. That's why they had the Reedy Creek Improvement District, so that they could govern that. It really is a city, a small town, you know, built for fun. When I say that, I'm not really joking. It's that big. It takes me from my house in Celebration, it takes me 18 minutes to get to the Magic Kingdom. And of that 18 minutes, I think 12 of it are actually on Disney property in Central Florida. Like 2/3 of my trip is actually on Disney property. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, there's an amazing moment when you're coming from the airport, when you sort of enter Disney property and, you know, you can travel for 20 minutes to get to your hotel, but you never see anything outside of the world. It's a wonderful sort of ease in.
Yeah, it actually spans two entire counties in Florida, Osceola and Orange County. Yeah.
Are Disney good citizens? Like, you know, well, part of me thinks like when they open Villains World, Ron DeSantis will be featured. But are Disney, you know, in some ways they're very progressive and seem to, you know, try to get clean energy and a lot of inclusion. Are they generally doing this all for the right reasons?
So it's a complicated question. You know, the management is definitely, as I mentioned, concerned almost entirely with shareholder returns. But they know that I'll give them credit. They know that they have a social responsibility both to their employees and to the public at large. For their employees, they want to make sure that their employees are well represented. Especially for a creative industry like that, it would be difficult for, you know, a representative sample of the population in the creative industry to not be represented in their movies, right? So if you talk about like the LGBTQIA community or, you know, Native Americans or whatever, any group, right, wants to see themselves represented in the movies. And I think Disney has done an exceptional job under the constraints that they have for doing that. They could always do more, right? But they are, within the constraints that they have, they are making the right steps. I'll say that. I think, this is just me talking, I think they were a little bit late in opposing Ron DeSantis's legislation, and that got them slapped down. That's how they lost control of the Reedy Creek Improvement District. I'm not going to go into that now. I thought that was the right idea for them to, the right thing for them to do. In general, yeah, I think they're good corporate citizens. They could always do more around wages, and especially ensuring that everyone has a living wage. The difficulty that you have there is, you know, again, it goes back to this idea of maximizing shareholder returns. That's going to come at the expense of employees and, you know, the community at large. So that's always the tension that they face, and they are kind of dogmatic about that. But yeah, they've made a number of other improvements. Like, they're very big in solar. Internally, they have, I believe, their own internal carbon tax, which drives internal decisions in the company to be more wise in use of resources. I don't think they talk about that for a variety of reasons that everyone will understand, but I believe that that's still operating. They have an extremely large solar farm in Walt Disney World. And I think they're, you know, even to the extent that it just affects their theme park businesses, they are concerned about things like that. Again, they can't talk about it because half the country doesn't believe that climate change is a thing. So they're not going to talk about that publicly. So I get that. I understand it. But behind the scenes, I think they're relatively progressive, especially in terms of other companies. Yeah. And so is Universal. Universal, you know, same thing. Both of those companies are doing what they can.
Let's go back to the beginning. Folks are going to go to Disney. They're afraid. They've heard, you know, the horror stories. What are the biggest tips? Is it to use a touring plan, get there for park opening? Are those the two biggest?
All right. So I'll start with this. I really think you should stay at a Disney-owned hotel. So like one of their value resorts, the All-Star Resorts or Pop Century or Art of Animation, for a couple of reasons. One is I've actually stayed at over 100 hotels in Orlando. The money you're going to save staying off-site is not worth the aggravation. There's no way that you're going to find a clean, comfortable, functioning, and safe hotel room for $50 a night in Orlando these days. It's just not going to happen. So the incremental cost of staying at a Disney hotel is totally going to be worth it. I have stories. Don't ask. Only once have I been woken up by bugs crawling on me. Let's put it that way, Michael. But I know. Only once. I had to, yeah. Anyway. But the other thing is, when you stay at a Disney hotel, you get access to every theme park every day, 30 minutes before the general public is. And that is a tremendous advantage. Because when you walk into the park, there's no one in line ahead of you. And you can easily get your top two rides out of the way before anyone else is in the parks. But if you're staying offsite, if you're trying to save money by staying at a non-Disney hotel, by the time you set foot in the parks, thousands of people will already be in line ahead of you. And there's really, really, really no way you can recover from that. So staying at a Disney hotel, I know it costs a little bit more money, but it's totally worth it in terms of benefits. Also, you get free transportation to and from the parks. You don't have to pay for parking. So I really think that is where you would start. The second thing is, I guess this is a little self-serving, but I really think you should have some sort of touring plan, or at least a sketch of an itinerary that you have. And I don't say here that you need to have every minute of your day scheduled, but what I would say is this: for every day that you want to be in Disney World, take an hour to plan out what you want to see in that park, where you want to eat, you know, what time you want to arrive, what time you want to take your breaks, stuff like that. And then have a general idea of the rides you want to ride. Which ride should you go to first? Because that is super important. And then what rides can you wait for the middle of the day? Like shows, parades, things like that. Those are perfect for the middle of the day because they never run at capacity. You can always go to them at any time. And the middle part of the day is the most crowded, so that's the perfect time to go see shows. So you want to see like the popular rides either first thing in the morning or very late at night. Third thing I would say is take a nap. If you have small, and this is why staying on site is also important too. You can go back to your hotel for a nap pretty quickly, right? But if you've got small children, you're going to be either overstimulated by noon or you're going to be overstimulated and hot by noon. Go back to your hotel, take a nap for a couple of hours, eat lunch at your hotel, take a dip in the pool. And then 4 or 5 o'clock, when the sun starts setting, it starts to get a little bit cooler, then go back to the parks and stay until they close, right? That's the best way. Also, I would build in, for every 2 days you're in the park, I would build in 1 day of rest, or at least a morning of rest, where you don't have to give it up every day early, because you'll get burned out really, really fast. So, have a plan, stay on site, build in rest, and have some idea of what you want to do. Those are the four big tips. Everything after that is details.
I totally agree with all of that. The swim nap thing is great, and I agree. I just started the, have to rope drop every day. You know, you can. You don't have to be ashamed of not doing that. Yeah.
You know, the good thing is if you go more than once, you don't have to hit every ride every time too. You can save some rides for your next trip too. So
that's right. I want to remind folks that the unofficial guide to Walt Disney World. I looked this morning on Amazon. It was for sale for $20.60. It's a 572-page book. It's a great value. The brand new 2025 edition is out. Folks can go to touringplans.com for information about a lot of what we've talked about. And the Disney Dish with Jim Hill is at jimhillmedia.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Let's close out with a couple quick questions. Your favorite snack on Disney property is what?
Mickey-shaped pretzel with the glow-in-the-dark cheese and a Coke.
Classic.
I hope my doctor's not listening to this. Oh, God. Yeah. Go ahead.
Favorite restaurant, and you are not allowed to say the tequila bar, which I know is really your favorite.
Okay. Victoria and Albert's is the best restaurant in Walt Disney World and has the best food and the best service. But if I'm just there for, like, I just want a burger or something fast, Pecos Bill's in Frontierland or Satouli Canteen in Animal Kingdom. Those are my two.
Interesting, because Pecos Phil taking some hits recently with the ratings. Tell me about your favorite ride, period. No hedging.
God, it was Splash Mountain because I fell in love with it before I knew what the movie was. Right now, it is probably Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway, which is a ride through the new Mickey Mouse cartoons in Disney's Hollywood Studios. If you guys haven't seen these, Disney started remaking Mickey Mouse cartoons about 10 years ago. They've put out almost 100 of them. They are the best Mickey Mouse cartoons ever made, and this ride is based on that. It's funny. It's Mickey Mouse like you've never seen him. It's contemporary. They are fabulous, fabulous cartoons. Some of them are the best animation work Disney's ever done, and so this ride is based on that. I love it. There's a million things to see in it. Kids love it. It's the ride I go on every time I'm in the studios.
Yeah, I also just completely love that ride, and that ride replaced a kind of a head scratcher ride for me. So it's like a win-win. Len Testa, thank you so much for giving us so much of your time. I know you're a ridiculously busy guy, and this has been super, super duper fascinating. And I really do think what you're doing is important, and somehow in a big way, but also just for the thousands of people that go to Disney and have 4 hours saved. Do the math. It's a lot of saved hours. So thank you.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. It's been a great career, and I'm looking forward to the future. We'll be right back.